KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray. I am KSL's resident political science professor, and I'm by myself this evening, but we're still going to have a great conversation. I'm hoping that you, like me, are getting texts from KSL News Radio, because then you get to know all the most important things, and I feel like you'll get those beats during the day, and then you cap off your evening with a KSL at Night, a conversation about what all is happening. So if you want to get those texts, so you know all the things that we know here, is you want to text BREAKING, B-R-E-A-K-I-N-G, to 57500, and you'll start getting some updates straight to your phone. All right, let's get into what's happening right now. Unless you have really not been paying attention for the last couple of years, we have been having a conversation in this country about military support to Ukraine. Ukraine has become kind of a divisive issue. It splits the country. It splits mostly the Republican Party, interestingly, as they try to figure out what side they want to come down on. Then in the last 6 months, when Gaza, when everything kind of exploded in Gaza, kind of blew up there, then it is the case that we're now building into this a story around whether we have funding for Israel. Then you add like the 6-year conversation about funding for border security, and all of it becomes kind of a hot mess. To help us figure out where we are currently, because there is a legislation in our Congress right now in the United States Senate, we've got with us Bridger Beal-Savetko, KSL.com reporter. Welcome to the show, Bridger.
Hey, thanks, Leah. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so Bridger, I feel like that was a really wordy, hot mess of an intro, but I feel like this whole story is a wordy, hot mess of a story, right? Bridger, can you bring us up to speed and our listeners, just in case they aren't paying close attention, what is the, you know, like, what is the problem that we're talking about?
Yeah, well, I think you said it really well. And, you know, there's this Ukraine issue that's been going on for several years, war in Gaza, concerns about China potentially invading Taiwan down the road. So it's kind of a mess because there's just a lot going on in the world right now. And Democrats and a lot of Republicans in Congress since October have been trying to approve more funding to Ukraine, economic and military aid there, as well as to Israel and Taiwan to help them out. And there's some other policies, like you mentioned, border security, a possible bill to force the parent company of TikTok to divest if they don't meet some requirements or sell to an American company. So a lot that's been going on in the House on Saturday. They stayed late into the weekend to pass a series of 4 bills, this funding package for foreign aid that includes money to Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and then kind of a grab bag bill with that TikTok policy, sanctions against Russia and other things like that have kind of been long anticipated and haven't been able to get any traction on those until now.
All right. So here's what I think is interesting, right? Our congressional delegation was split on the vote for Ukraine, right? My understanding is 2 of our members voted for funding for Ukraine, 2 of our members voted against. So that just gives you an idea when I talk about how the Republican Party is not in one place on this. And the article that you have is about Senator Lee. You tell us, I won't give away the ending. Where is Senator Lee on funding for Ukraine?
Yeah, he's long been opposed to it. And he's said in social media, you know, it's not that he doesn't think that Ukraine should be able to defend itself or doesn't want Putin to win necessarily, but that he's not for sending the amount of aid that the U.S. has been spending in Ukraine. He wants to see it spent on border security, other policies like that. Isn't a fan of the price tag involved. So he's been working to rally enough Republicans in the Senate to block this bill in the Senate that the House passed, you know, until some of those other conditions are met. But from what I can tell, from everything I've seen, it looks like there's enough Republicans and Democrats in the Senate to approve this bill, possibly later tonight or tomorrow morning, and send it to the president.
All right, so Bridger, I want to talk right there. You've got in your article a picture of a I don't know if they're called tweets anymore, but a tweet on X by Based Mike Lee, which a little bit is his more out of the box channel, right? Like where he talks about things a little more feisty, I think. And on this, in this picture, it is, you know, a woman holding a hand of a guy, and it's like Republican Party, Democratic Party, and the conservative is the one being cheated on. And he says, please like and share if this resonates with you. What is it about Senator Lee that he doesn't see what's happening the same way that, like, for example, Senator McConnell or maybe even our own Senator Romney do, right? That they see these crises as one of a piece, right? The Taiwan one that you brought up, the aid for Israel, the aid for Ukraine as kind of a, you know, stabilizing force, if you will, making sure that these authoritarian regimes don't have big push. What is, like, why does Mike Lee just see it so differently?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but it has been an issue that's split the Republican Party. You know, if you think back to the Ronald Reagan days, he kind of had this ethos of peace through strength and aiding our allies abroad, like Ukraine or other allies in Europe and things like that. And there's kind of a split right now in the Republican Party. I think former President Donald Trump has been much less hawkish in some ways, as far as aiding allies. He's been a big critic of NATO, a treaty alliance. And I think for other reasons, I think specifically spending, Mike Lee is a, you know, a fiscal conservative, you know, wants to cut the budget, doesn't want the federal government to spend as much. I think it's been a big change from those conservatives who are maybe a little more more fiscally focused, whereas some of the old guard, like Mitch McConnell and I think Mitt Romney, has been more supportive of Ukraine, see this as a real, you know, not only an issue to help our allies, but see it as helping to prevent the spread of, or, you know, help prevent Russia from gaining more power, kind of think it in America's best national security interest to kind of deter an enemy like that. And same thing with China. I hope that answers your question.
Oh, no, yeah. And Bridger, I've got a question for you. Follow up to that a little bit. So I Googled, where is Senator Romney or where is Mitt Romney on this Ukraine bill in there today? And I'm going to tell you, like, the most recent reporting I see is like a couple of months ago where he's talking about it. Do you have a sense of where he's voting? Did I just miss that? Like, where is he going to be on this legislation?
You know, I have not seen a specific statement on this package of bills. When they last tried, they actually tried to pass a bill linking Ukraine aid to border spending, some enhanced border security measures back in February, I believe. And Mitt Romney was on board with that proposal. Mike Lee wasn't, even though he's said that he wants to see the border addressed in a bigger way. Mike Lee was still in, didn't think that bill went far enough towards securing the border, but Mitt Romney was supportive of that. So I would guess that he is supportive of this new package, or specifically Ukraine aid.
All right, Bridger, so let's look into your crystal ball a little bit. So you think, so what I hear you saying is Senator Lee is trying to block getting to that 60 vote, right? So listener, Senate needs 60 votes to do anything. They need a supermajority whenever it's something kind of, you know, controversial like this, because they need to be filibuster proof. So we're looking, you said, I think earlier, later this evening or tomorrow, that this bill comes through. How do you think it goes? Does it pass?
I do think it does. Talking about that filibuster proof majority, I believe it was a little less than an hour ago, actually, that they voted to close debate on that bill. And I believe it got 80 votes to break the filibuster. So they haven't voted on the final package, kind of given it final approval. But it has cleared that initial hurdle. So it does look like there's enough, enough Republicans and Democrats who are both in favor of the proposal, and it should pass, pretty easily at this point, I think.
Okay. Bridger Beals of Echo, thank you so much for keeping us up to date on this. KSL.com reporter, thank you for joining the show.
Yep, happy to be here. Thanks.
All right, listeners, next up on KSL at Night, we're going to pivot to the Chad Daybell, Lori Vallow Daybell drama that's been going on, because we've got more on the Daybell Myrtle trial. Stay with us. KSL at Night. And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and we are talking about all the most interesting things that are happening. We are going to get into now the Chad Daybell trial that, my goodness, I think we've been covering for quite a while. If you've missed any of our recent shows or more further back shows as this story kind of developed, you could totally check them out on our podcast. So you go to kslpodcast.com or, quite frankly, any app where you download podcasts, just look up KSL at Night. And a little bit, if you search like Daybell trial or Lori Vallow trial, you would be able to find all the conversations that we've had about it if you want to, you know, kind of dig more deeply into what we're about to talk about. So today, jurors for the Chad Daybell murder trial heard more testimony, and a little bit, listeners, I think it got, I don't know, I want to say creepy, definitely was interesting. And to help me figure out what's going on, I've got Greg Skordas, who is KSL's own legal analyst and is tracking this trial closely for us to kind of bring us up to speed. Greg, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
Greg, so first of all, before we get too much into the weeds, give us kind of context. Where are we at in this trial? Is it, you know, today is Tuesday. When did, like, where are we? Are we in the middle of testimony? Are we closing on the end? Is prosecution up? Like, just give everyone the context of where we are currently.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think we're day two of week three of the trial. It's moved at a little bit of a slow pace. The state is still putting on their evidence. They're still putting on their trial. They've told the court that they need at least 5 or 6 weeks. So my guess is we're probably over the hump. We're over the halfway point for the state's case. Of course, the defense hasn't put on its case yet, but under the rules, the state goes first, and then the defense gets to put on its case. So, yeah, we're well into the state's case and well into the forensics, FBI experts, and other witnesses.
All right. So I was reading, I feel like something creepy is happening today, but let me have our listeners hear it directly from you. What is the development that's going on in today's, what did the jurors hear today?
Well, two real significant things, Leah. One, we heard from Tylee's older brother who was talking to his mother, Lori Vallow, about Tylee, who sort of said goodbye to her one day when he was working at Planet Fitness where he was employed. And it was clear that something was amiss, something was wrong. He was communicating with Tylee pretty regularly on her Facebook. But after a couple of days, those communications changed. And I think if you read between the lines, and it's not hard, he's assuming that he's not talking to Tylee anymore at all. He's talking to Lori, who's using Tylee's device and acting as though she is her daughter in a way to make him think that she's still alive and she's doing fine. He then talks about the fact that his father is killed. Lori at first says it was a heart attack and then admits that Alex Cox killed him in self-defense and is really nonchalant about it. I mean, she lost her husband. It's awful. And she's just kind of moving on and saying, you know, your mother will be married again soon. And the Lord has everything under control. So very creepy. But more importantly, Leah, and I know I'm rambling a bit, we heard from an FBI agent who went through the text messages between Chad and Lori. And I'll tell you why this is important. Chad has, from the beginning of this trial, maintained that he was manipulated by Lori, that he's the one who was the follower and that she was the one who was calling all the shots. His attorney said that right out of the chute in the opening statement, and that has been his defense so far. Lori, and Alex Cox, they did everything. But if you look at these text messages between Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow, he is really manipulating her to the point where he's saying, you know, you're not responding to me, you're not talking to me, the angels are upset at you, they're not protecting you anymore, you need to respond to me. And so she finally sends him something back saying, hey, I love you. And then he replies, okay, the angels are protecting you again. So in that context, Leah, it seems that Chad is much more engaged with the manipulation part. And he's not the one that's being led around. He's doing just as much of it to her as she is to him.
So, Greg, can you talk to me real quick right there about, like, I feel like, doesn't the defense know these texts exist, right? So you had said earlier and just now that the defense right out of the gate says, right, this is Lori Vallow is the manipulator in this. Chad Daybell is just kind of going along with it. But then these texts, right, like, seems to me like if you were a criminal defense attorney and you know these texts exist, how could you ever have made the argument that they are trying to make in this case?
Well, I think, Leah, it's the only argument the defense can make, that because Lori's been convicted, and the jury's got to live with that, that children were killed, that Lori and Chad had something to do with that they were found dead on Chad's property. And so Chad has tried to distance himself. And again, if you look at he's manipulating her, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's a killer. And I think his attorney's going to say, okay, he wasn't the complete dupe. He was involved in this as much as she is. But what does that have to do with the murder? I know that's a little bit of a stretch, and I think the jury's going to see through that a little bit. But he's always tried to distance himself from Lori's manipulation. This just brought him into that. And yes, his attorney had to have known about these texts for years now and had to have been anticipating them, didn't address them in his opening remarks, probably could have taken a little bit of the wind out of the sails had he done that, but for whatever reason he chose not to.
So I was reading in a KSL story that basically the FBI agent gets asked, right, if there's any very clear, you know, let's kill the kids kind of text messages. Greg, what was there? Like, the answer is no, but I guess there is some, like, it seems like it's obvious that was being discussed.
Yeah, I mean, I practiced for 42 years and I've never seen a drug conspiracy where they say, hey, let's sell the drugs tonight. I mean, there's always, everything's always a little bit in code. You know, he's talking about, you know, we've got to kill the raccoon. We've got to get rid of the spirits. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. I mean, no one ever comes out and admits to a crime in their text messages. That's so rare. But if you read between the lines and you put them all in context, I think that the FBI has done a great job of that, and the state has as well. You can see what's going on. And if you it's a picture that the state's trying to paint, which is that these two were conspiring to get rid of people that were in their way, the dark souls, the dark figures. And Tylee and JJ unfortunately got caught up in that web. And yeah, I think that it doesn't take much of a stretch to look at these texts and some of the communications between Lori and Chad and see exactly what the state's theory is, and that they were both equally culpable in those kids' homicide.
All right, and now that you know this information, does it change your perspective of, you know what I mean, like where we go from here, or what happens with what the defense, how they might put on a case?
Not really. I mean, I think that we knew that some of this was coming. The defense has always maintained, hey, wait, we've got four experts ourselves. We're also going to put on Chad's children. I think they're still going to make Lori out to be the monster in this and go even further and say the state's case isn't quite as good as you think. Some of their forensics, some of their DNA, some of the other analysis that was done maybe isn't quite as compelling as you might think. The autopsy of Tammy, for example, some of the findings with respect to Tylee and JJ, and the DNA that's found. So I think the defense is going to say, you still got to tie Chad to it. You still got to put him there. You still have to do something to get him on the scene of these homicides. And they're going to say the state can't do that. Of course, it's a circumstantial case in large respect. And we'll see what the jury ultimately decides.
All right, so talk to us. I like how you said earlier, it's day two of week three. In the last minute I've got left with you, where do we go from here? When do you think the state rests? Like, how much longer do we have? What should we be paying attention to?
I think the state's going to hone in on some of the more details of terms of autopsy, finish up with their forensics, and the big picture between Lori and Chad. Keep going with these text messages, these phone calls, even communications between the two of them after they were arrested, and kind of seal the deal. My guess is that the state's case will continue throughout this entire week. And probably all of next week. Whether it goes much further than that, it remains to be seen. And then the defense will put on its case. It should be fairly short, less than a week.
Greg Skordas, KSL legal analyst, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You bet. Nice to hear your voice, Leah.
Next up on KSL at Night, listeners, let's have a conversation with Congresswoman Celeste Molloy about a meeting that happened around land down in Washington County. Stay with us.
KSL at night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and we are talking about all the most interesting things that are happening in politics right now. I want you all to know that I grew up in upstate New York in a very suburban area. So rural politics was not something I was aware of. And as a political scientist, I don't teach about rural politics. It's something I'm not always really paying attention to. But last year in Congress District 2, in that special election, Congresswoman Celeste Molloy and the way that I feel she framed her election, which was about rural voters being ignored, really made me think, oh, no, this is a whole thing. Like the 20% of Americans actually live in rural parts of the country, and how it is the case that we are not talking about these voters and what they want. And then also nationally, I think the misunderstanding of rural voters, like you'll hear a lot on national media talking about them as having rage. And the answer is there's really not rural voter rage. Anyway, I'm interested in it. And so I'm so happy to say that I've got Representative Celeste Molloy on tonight to have a conversation with me about a recent event that's happening that I think maybe speaks to this a little bit. Welcome to the show, Congresswoman.
Thank you. It's always nice to be on here.
Yeah. So I was reading this article about a meeting you all had about the kind of Southern Utah and the use of land and the conflict between the federal and the local government. And a little bit, Congresswoman, just correct me if I'm wrong, but a little bit what I was hearing in that article was these voters who live, right? Like one of the people was saying, I've lived here since 1849, I think is the year. I might have that year wrong. Yeah. No one loves this country and this county more than I do. This feels like I'm not being heard. Am I pinging off of this right, Congresswoman? Is this something that kind of, you know, is that same vibe as you were really tapping into last year?
Yeah, that's exactly the read I got from that, too. It wasn't a meeting per se. It was a congressional field hearing. So it was a hearing with the House Natural Resources Committee in Hurricane yesterday. John Curtis, Blake Moore, and I were there. And it was about the overreach of federal government into how our local governments are doing their jobs. Particularly, we focused yesterday on the issues with tortoise habitat in the Northern Corridor in Washington County. And Washington County is interesting because parts of it are rural, and I wouldn't call St. George rural anymore, but they have these big public lands problems and the dealing with the agency overreach problems that the rural areas have.
I appreciate what you just – thank you for correcting me. So I was calling it a meeting, but actually it's a congressional field hearing. Can you explain to us what that is and how do you set that up and what does that mean?
So that means it is just like the hearings you watch on C-SPAN. Only this time we were sitting in an absolutely beautiful location with no air conditioning. And the people who were able to participate are people in Southern Utah. And it was really hot yesterday. So I appreciate everybody who sat there and baked in the sun. It was hot for this time of year. And normally when we have a hearing about, you know, public land access, that's going to happen in a hearing room in Washington, D.C. But this time the committee came here and we sat in Hurricane and we heard from the county commissioner and the county attorney and UDOT and a developer and the Water Conservancy District talking about the things that they're trying to do to make life better in Washington County and the roadblocks they run into because of the federal processes they have to go through and the federal agency involvement in those decisions.
Congresswoman Molloy, why don't you run all of your hearings this way? I mean, other than the lack of air conditioning, but like, you know, why are you not always, so I guess maybe flip that question, why is it a good thing to get out into our, right, more local areas to have these conversations rather than being in a hearing room back in D.C.?
It's good for so many reasons. It's good for the members of Congress to get out here and see people who live with these issues every day. Unfortunately, because we were voting all weekend, it threw people's travel schedules off. So we only had Utah members there yesterday. But it's good for the committee staff to be here and see on the ground the things they're working on. It's really important for the people who live here to be able to be engaged in that process and be part of it. We have people from Utah come testify in committee hearings, but it's expensive. It's difficult. Somebody has to get on a plane, fly to Washington, D.C. to give a 5-minute testimony, and only so many people can do that. But yesterday we had, I never got a head count, but there was a good crowd there of people who live in this area who got to watch their government work, who got to watch their representatives representing them. And I think that's really important.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. You were singing like my heart just right. Like just how do we get people civically educated? How do we get them civically engaged? And the obstacles, right? I'm never going to be in a hearing room back in DC, right? And so to be able to have conversations about local issues, oh my gosh, so important. And I appreciate that work. All right. So now let's pivot to the issue. So it's about, what did you say? The tortoise habitats and kind of the management of public lands. So talk to me about, yeah. I feel like, you know, since I moved to Utah 22 years ago, we talk about this a lot. So is this just the same kind of the federal government's really not understanding the issue? And we've been talking about that for decades. Or is there something more recent as part of this conversation as well? Like some new problem we've got to try to address?
It's a little bit of both.
Okay.
So it's the same problem. The federal government manages the majority of the land in this state, which means they have a huge stake in every decision that our local governments are trying to make. The Northern Corridor, the road that we were talking about yesterday in the hearing, is one that's been on Washington County's transportation plan for 30 years, I think a little more than 30 years. But in order to build this road, they have to go through all these federal processes. And now it's even more difficult because in the early 2000s, Washington County started negotiating with federal agencies and environmental groups and the cities and the state on a Washington County lands bill to try to settle a lot of these questions with the public land and what is and isn't allowed. And what happened is the Washington County lands bill passed in 2009 as part of an omnibus public lands management act. It was signed by President Obama. And some of the things that were agreed to in that bill have been implemented and some of them haven't. And the county feels like the things that have been implemented are the things they gave up. And the things they asked for in return, the agencies are just dragging their feet on. And this isn't the way to run a country. This isn't the way for governments to work together.
Yeah.
And so it's some of the same old thing, but also some of it's new because a lot of it is politics. They got a record of decision on a route for that road at the end of the Trump administration. Then the Biden administration came in and repealed the record of decision. Well, now we've got another presidential election coming up, so the issue's ripe again. And that's no way to run a country. Who sits in the White House shouldn't have that big of an impact on a local transportation plan.
Yeah, I love that sentence right there, Congresswoman Malloy. Exactly. Oh my gosh, exactly. All right, so talk to us. Let me ask you a question that came maybe from people who were not super happy about the field hearing that happened. Holly Snow Canada, the executive director of Conserve Southwest Utah, told the Deseret News that, quote, local and indigenous voices were excluded from the hearing, end quote. Can you just speak to that a little bit?
Sure. She told me that too yesterday. And the truth is, this was a congressional field hearing. So the way those work, the way a congressional hearing works is that the majority calls a hearing and the minority calls usually one witness and the majority calls three or some ratio where there's a certain number of majority witnesses, a certain number of minority witnesses. The entire Natural Resources Committee was invited to this hearing and the Democrats didn't show up and they didn't call a witness. That's not something that I can fix.
Right.
And so if right. their voices were excluded, it was excluded by the minority party in the House, which is the Democrats.
No, I got you. And I like, again, right, everyone's got to operate in good faith, right, Congresswoman, if we're going to solve these problems. And I hear you saying the federal government really hasn't. And now maybe, you know, Democrats haven't either. And then it becomes a political issue that they can talk about. Thank you so much.
I will say,
go ahead.
Quickly before we go.
Yeah.
I've been involved in these negotiations for a lot of years now in several different capacities. And those voices have had a seat at the table. They may not have been testifying yesterday, but the Paiute tribes in southern Utah have been very involved. And Conserve Southwest Utah has been very involved. This has not been an exclusive process in the last 20 years. They've all been there.
Congresswoman Celeste Malloy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
All right. Next up on KSL at Night, listeners, we're going to have a conversation about artificial intelligence and, you know, what jobs are maybe the safest from that and what jobs are more at risk. Stick with us.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
Good evening and welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Leah Murray and we are talking about all the most interesting things. So artificial intelligence, I feel like, don't you just feel like we must be in the age of when we decided to start driving cars and all of the people who made carriages and whatever connected a horse to a carriage must have just been completely freaking out, right? Like, so what's going to happen to my carriage industry because this car is going to automate all of that? A little bit, listeners, I feel the conversations around artificial intelligence reveal quite a bit of the angst when an industry changes, right? So if it is the case that I can now automate a lot of work that I'm doing, what labor, what sectors of our industry, what's going to mostly be hurt by that? And the Deseret News has got a great article. You really should read it to dive into what's going on. Let me just give you kind of top of line takeaways. The answer is that about 30% of current working hours in the U.S. economy could become AI automated by 2030. And a recent Pew Research analysis found that about 20% of workers could have high exposure to AI. By the way, that doesn't mean they're being displaced. It just means maybe AI is going to be a major part of their job or maybe could lead to displacement. When we're thinking about that, there's a couple of business sectors that we're talking about. When we're thinking about healthcare, right, mental health, like talking to a therapist probably can't be AI, so that's probably safe. But, you know, maybe doing all of the coding, right, and all the things that you might write down that you're submitting to health insurance companies, that might become automated. When we think about law, you all know that I have picked on our own Greg Skordas, KSL's legal analyst, about like, what do I need a lawyer for? I just go into ChatGPT and have them write that brief for me. And what are the value adds? And the answer maybe is because lawyers don't just tell you what the law says. They actually help you make some decisions, right? So the lawyers might still be there. Creative professionals. In an interview with Fortune, Adobe senior vice president was talking about how AI won't necessarily end graphic design jobs, right? So the answer is not, like, I love this reference, right? They're like, just because we invented a camera doesn't mean we stopped painting, right? So again, when we change the industry, doesn't necessarily change everything. But as you all know, I'm in higher education, and we have had conversations up on my campus about AI. A lot of what I deal with my colleagues is, man, can you ever have the exam just be like a 10-page essay ever again, right? Because the answer is a smart student can feed into any kind of ChatGPT the prompt you gave them and maybe get an excellent answer right back, and you as the professor might have a hard time figuring that out. To help me kind of answer these questions, we've brought in Peter Stone, who is a professor of computer science at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
All right. So first of all, you can correct anything that I just said that might have been wrong because you're a computer science professor, which makes me feel like you probably know a lot more about AI than I do. Are there any industries that you're thinking, oh, no, like that one you said is totally going to be in trouble, or the ones I didn't mention? Like, what do you want to add to that?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't think about it as industries being in trouble. I would think of it as industries transforming or changing. As you said, you know, this is not the first time in history that technology has changed the jobs landscape. And, you know, so those carriage manufacturers from when cars were invented, the people who went into that probably went into something else a generation later or a few years later. And I think, you know, that's the same thing that's going to happen. There used to be a lot more people who washed dishes than before dishwashers were invented. So same kind of thing. I think that a lot of jobs will, there are AI technologies that the jobs will transform and make it so that people need different skills to do the jobs. But I think, you know, there will be also new jobs created, and you know that all, you know, there's a lot of people employed by factories that make dishwashers. I think, you know, that same kind of thing. It's very easy for people to get sort of, you know, concerned about losing the status quo. But, you know, hopefully and historically, technologies have improved productivity and, you know, made the whole economy work more smoothly and more efficiently. And hopefully that'll happen here as well.
All right. So let's dive into our, you know, mutual industry of education. Can you talk to us about, I guess, first, let me ask you, there's a lot of angst on my campus around artificial intelligence and what it's going to do. And I feel like mostly from philosophy professors, right? Because the way they did things were big, long essays. And their worry is, do we have to kind of go back to oral exams? Do you feel like that angst is warranted? Like, what are we talking about there?
No, actually, I think it's all the sort of angst about people, students cheating is a little bit of a red herring, because that's not new, right? I mean, those same philosophy professors, if they assigned a 10-page essay, their students could have already gone and, you know, paid a fair amount, a little bit of money to have somebody else write the essay for them. Or they could have, and, you know, that may have been even less detectable than using ChatGPT. The ability and propensity for students to cheat is sort of, I think, roughly the same as it was before. There's a little bit of barrier removed. You know, it's a little easier to use these tools. But, you know, the point of education is to improve your brain. And, you know, the students, the analogy that I like is, you know, the football player whose coach tells them to go and you know, lift a set of weights 20 times isn't going to go and get a machine to lift the weights 20 times for them, because that would defeat the purpose. The purpose of lifting the weights was to improve their muscles. The purpose of doing that assignment was to improve your brain. And if, you know, if students want to cheat, they're mainly cheating themselves. That does leave professors in sort of the position of, do we want to police cheating and say, you know, we're going to catch it and punish it? Or do we want to, sort of let cheating be its own punishment? But I don't think that's a new question or a new phenomenon. There has been cheating, and if you want to be sure that an essay is written by a person, yes, it has to be an in-class essay or an oral exam. But I think that was the case before ChatGPT as well.
All right. And I liked how you talked earlier about it's going to transform industries. And in the article I was reading, you were quoted as saying that it will transform teachers' jobs, right? So you've got this quote about a teacher's ability to watch the student, to adjust the curriculum when students aren't adjusting. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you think specifically that might look like in a classroom?
Sure. I mean, personalized education, I mean, is, you know, something that we can look forward to. In a teacher in a large class has to sort of teach to the median, right? You want to make sure that the students in the middle are doing, you know, are following the material. That could leave a few students at the bottom of the class struggling to keep up. It could leave some students at the top of the class completely bored. But being able to, you know, to sort of have more personalized or individualized education could make it so that each student is challenged at exactly the right level for them. And, you know, that would be a big win for teachers in the classroom. And I think that's something that becomes more feasible with, you know, some recent AI technologies. And I think some standardized tests have gone to this as well. It's no longer the case that if you take some standardized tests online, it's no longer the case that everybody gets the same questions. It's, you know, if you answer a question right, you get some harder questions. You answer a question wrong, you get some easier questions. But, you know, that could be happening more and more, you know, seamlessly in every classroom.
No, I love that. And I was thinking, one of the things I do in my own classroom, Peter, is there's a lot of conversation. And I always am thoughtful about who might not be, how do I say, answering as much, right? Because students can really mm-hmm. dominate in a conversation style. So I hear you, and maybe there's some kind of AI technology I could deploy, right? That would kind of track, I don't know, like how many words are said, right? Then you could say to a student, man, you are eating up a lot of time. Could you just back off? But you've got data like to talk about it.
I think the other important point is that, you know, AI technologies are things that we need to, yes, it can cause angst, like that it might make evaluating what students know more difficult, but it's also sort of a responsibility for us to teach students how to use these tools responsibly. When they leave, when they graduate, when they go out to the workforce, employers are going to expect them to know how to use and how when to use and when not to use, right? So you talked about, you know, lawyers having LLMs write the briefs for them, but that famously went wrong for a lawyer last year who sort of trusted it, didn't verify that it was not making things up, and indeed it was making things up as they're wont to do. And so, you know, it's important that our students know how to use them to maybe improve the fluency of their language, of their writing, but also know how to double check and how to you know, make sure that when they're consulted, that they're also verified.
Professor Peter Stone, computer science at the University of Texas at Austin, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. Thank you so much, listeners, for listening to KSL at Night. We'll see you next time.